KPCW News Time now, 8:08. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. Stay tuned. In just a minute here, we'll be checking in with Jeremy McAllister, one of the lead engineers with the Heber City Airport Master Plan, along with Heber City Manager Matt Brower. Also be checking in with Summit County Manager Tom Fisher, and also with one of the organizers of the Backcountry Gate petition sent to Vail Resorts. Well, on Thursday, Heber City and Heber Valley Airport hosting an open house starting at 6 o'clock. It'll be a virtual meeting with a mix of presentations as well as a live Q&A session with the experts there. There will be a review of the progress that the Flight Path team has made, as well as learning about the data that's been collected that will drive the rest of the planning process. On the phone with a preview, I have Jerry McAllister. He is the lead engineer from TO Engineers, preparing the master plan along with Heber City Manager Matt Brower. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning.
Matt, let's start with you. How do people participate on Thursday?
As you indicated, Leslie, this will be a virtual meeting, and anyone who would like to participate can go to HeberValleyFlightPath.com and gain access to the virtual link. And, of course, at 6 o'clock on Thursday, they can type that link in and be part of the meeting.
Okay. So you've got an hour and a half of program for the meeting. How much time will be spent reviewing and how much time answering questions?
I would estimate that about 45 minutes will be spent reviewing. Mayor Potter will have some introductory comments. Jeremy and his team will have some comments regarding the status of our work. And quite frankly, we'll stay as late as the attendees want to answer questions. We're dedicated to providing as much information as we can, and we'll stay as late as they want to stay.
Now, do questions have to be submitted in advance?
No, we'll actually take questions during the actual open house as well. Again, the information is on the Flight Path website, so they can submit questions today. They can submit them also during the open house.
Okay. Jeremy, you have told us that this is being done for a couple of reasons. One, because you're required to by the Federal Aviation Administration. And two, it's about making the airport safer. The idea wasn't to allow bigger jets, just faster ones. Is that right?
Yeah, there's the safety standards, the design safety standards are set by a threshold of the traffic that's using the facility. That threshold is 500 operations annually. And so the current traffic that the airport is receiving is in excess of 500 operations for the next approach category up, which is really has to do with speed more than size. And so you hear the terms B2 and C2 in the discussion. That is what we're looking at is that alphanumeric code is really made up of two parts. The alpha being the alphabetical part has everything to do with approach speed. And then the numerical part, the 2 in this case, is related to the size of the aircraft, wingspan and tail height specifically. So looking at the forecast and the traffic that the airport's receiving, they're receiving more than 500 operations of aircraft that are approaching at a higher speed than the current design safety standards.
All right. And there was a photo of a jet that had allegedly landed at the airport last week, and it was big. I mean, it certainly was not the standard four-seater Cessnas that we've been used to. Is this what we're planning for the future, these bigger jets?
So I think you're talking about the Embraer 190 that was photographed landing, and that was a private plane. That plane is also used at other airports for commercial service. So yeah, it's a large plane. That particular plane, and again, I'm assuming you're talking about the Embraer there, that is a C3 category plane. Again, going back to that alphabet and that numerical, the approach speed is the C class, but really the size of the plane, which is I think what got people's attention, is a 3 category. And just to give you an idea, when you talk about wingspan of a 3 category, it's 79 feet or wider up to 118 feet. I believe that Embraer, wingspan is about 94 feet. So that's a big plane. We do show in the forecast that the airport's receiving a small amount of Group 3 aircraft. I believe the forecast shows around 100 aircraft a year right now that are in that three group. And certainly that Embraer was one of those. That's a three group aircraft.
All right. Well, I guess that I need more clarification. And if you say we're just kind of going from a B2 to a C2, then how come we're going on now to a C3? What's the max that we're going to be? We're going to be a D8?
Sure. Good question. The forecast projects out for the next 20 years, and we're actually not showing any additional safety upgrades beyond C2 for the out to 2041. Again, going back to that 500 operations, I believe we're showing, we do show some D aircraft, which is a faster speed, and we also show some three aircraft, which is a bigger size. But those operation numbers are, like I said, on the three is around 100, and we're forecasting that up to, I think, around 130 over the next 20 years. And as far as the D goes, I think we have about 200 operations, and we're showing an increase of up to 300 D operations.
So what's the limit that could actually land in the future if this master plan goes through? Is a D3 is as big and fast as they get?
Well, we actually look at the national trends and the size of the aircraft. You're asking for the limit, and as has been mentioned previously, ultimately the decision to land is determined by the pilot. So it's tough to say, this is the limit. What we look at is kind of what the trends are. We don't show, there's no data to support that we're going to need to increase to any further limit beyond C2. Hopefully that answers your question, yeah. But does that mean that a C3 cannot land or a D2 cannot land? No, it does not mean that. It just means that we don't have to plan for those.
All right. So, again, let's talk, because we keep hearing the word expansion. Is that incorrect to say what we're doing here? I think what I have heard is that we're lengthening the runway and the footprint of the airport isn't changing.
Leslie, let me take a shot at that one. First and foremost, the city, Norteo, is looking at lengthening the runway. In fact, the two factors that would determine the size of planes that can come in would be the thickness of the runway and the length of the runway. And the city has absolutely zero interest in thickening the runway or lengthening it. And we'll go to the mat to try to prevent that, because we've heard the public and we realize that they don't want those bigger aircraft. As I'm very confident to say that, we'll go to the mat to prevent that from happening. And so this is not really about airport expansion. This is really about trying to see what standards the FAA is going to require the city to allow for those C2 aircraft to come in safely. And that's it.
Okay, so there won't be any expansion to the runway as it currently exists?
In terms of its length, that is correct.
All right. did you want to add to that, Jamie?
Do you mind if I add to that, too, a little bit? Mm-hmm. just for clarification, too, in terms of the capacity, sorry, I'm getting a little bit of feedback, but there's no expansion either in terms of capacity. So when you talk about runway length, as Matt mentioned, we're not looking at any expansion in terms of length or capacity in terms of adding additional lanes. There will be, the runway would need to be widened. The difference between a B2 runway and a C2 runway is 25 feet of pavement. The current runway is 75 feet. C2 design safety standards are 100 feet, so about 12 and a half feet of pavement on each side.
All right, and Jeremy, what you've also told us, or maybe it was Matt, is that because the city accepted money from the Federal Aviation Administration, basically any plan that wants to land there can land there as long as the pilot feels like he or she is able to land there?
Yes, and conditions change daily. And I'm not a pilot, but I know like temperature and wind. There are a lot of factors that go into a runway. So it may be safe one day where it's unsafe the next day, depending on the conditions. But the city is not able to discriminate towards any one particular plane or pilot landing. Matt, I think I captured that correctly.
Yeah, and I think part of the master plan process is to see what we can do as the sponsor of the airport to make sure that we don't do anything to encourage larger aircraft from coming into the airport. And so part of the master plan is hearing from the public to get their ideas, but to make sure that we don't make any investments, again, that would encourage larger aircraft, because the community has spoken and they don't want larger aircraft, but we can't discriminate against anyone that can fly in safely.
So can you pay back the FAA and then just take it, do it on your own? Or can you just say from here on, we're not going to take any more FAA federal money and just have, you know, jurisdiction of the airport yourself?
So the bottom line is it's very difficult to walk away from a federal contract that's been agreed to repeatedly by the city for the last 40 years. We've essentially given up the right to say no, as we are now a grant-assured airport. And if we were to simply say no to the grant money, we currently pay 5% of all airport infrastructure costs. If we said no, we'd begin paying 100%. Mm-hmm. And so financially, it becomes also very difficult to economically afford that. And so it's a very difficult situation the city's in, because we have contractually agreed to comply with the 39 safety standards or the grant assurances that the FAA's laid out for all airports.
So is the Heber Airport a moneymaker for the city, Matt?
Heber Airport is unique in that it is operated in the black. It is self-sustaining and does not require at this time any general fund tax money to support it.
All right. Is it possible to make more money if you didn't have a fixed base operator?
That's difficult to say. Most airports do have a fixed base operator. Some have more than one. The fixed base operator is intended to provide services to the users of the airport. And so the fixed base operator we currently have, OK3, does a very good job at providing services to aircraft. Could we make more money? I'm not sure. We need to look at that business model as part of the master planning process. There's generally three revenues the airport gets right now. One is called a fuel flowage fee, two is a landing fee, and three, of course, are hangar fees. And those are really the three variables that we have at the airport to increase revenues.
All right. What are the terms of that FBO agreement? I mean, does it expire, or do you just renew it every year or every 5 years, or how does that work?
It is a long-term agreement. I forget the term of the agreement, but it is a long-term agreement. I think it expires in the 2030s, if I remember correctly. And the reason for that is when the city signs agreements either with a hangar owner or with an FBO, they make significant investments in the airport. And so the FAA, and as a city sponsor of the airport, we want to make sure they can get a return on those investments. And so that's why they're granted such long terms on those agreements.
Yeah. All right. And then just back to the you know, what this master plan, in terms of doing whatever we're going to do to the airport, will the airport remain fully operational?
During the master planning process?
Yeah. And during any improvements that we make to it.
I can say that during the master plan process, it will remain operational. If there's changes to the runway, as Jeremy's described, of having to widen it, those details are yet to really be fleshed out yet. And so I really can't comment on those details because I don't have them yet.
All right. And then do we know what kind of impact this is going to have on the neighborhoods and the flight path and the surrounding areas as we see just, you know, with the growth of the area?
Yeah, so one of these steps in the master planning process is to conduct an environmental review. And so as the community starts engaging the master planning group and giving their ideas, we'll have to identify what's called a preferred alternative. And once that's been identified, we'll have to look at running some environmental assessments against it to see what the noise impacts might be, to see what the pollution impacts might be. And that will further inform us as to what the next steps might be.
Okay, so again, Thursday is the opportunity for anybody to ask questions. You say it starts at 6 o'clock. People can find that information. Is it Heber Valley Flight Path? Is that correct?
That is correct. HeberValleyFlightPath.com. It is this Thursday, 6 o'clock. They can go to the website to get the virtual link. And again, we'll stay as late as there are questions to be answered. And I might also say that, Leslie, that the city's also established what we're calling an informal open house at the airport. This is not the same as what's happening this Thursday. What we're providing is an opportunity for people to come to the actual airport and take a tour and engage staff and learn more about it. And we have two dates coming up. The first is Wednesday, April 14th. At 10 a.m. and the second is Tuesday, April 27th at 5 p.m. and the address is 630 West Airport Road. And again, these are some informal opportunities for the public to actually get out on the airport and take a tour and actually drive on the runway and get a better sense for what's out there and become better informed and have an opportunity to engage staff on the questions and the issues.
Okay, Jeremy, anything you wanted to add?
No, I think Matt covered it pretty well. Just looking forward to the meeting and hopefully answering some questions and helping people, educate themselves on the process and then start to get involved and provide their input.
All right. Jeremy McAllister with TO Engineers and Heber City Manager Matt Brown. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Leslie.
Thank you, Leslie.
Summit County Council will be meeting virtually at 2:45 on Wednesday. On the phone with a preview, Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's see. At 2:45, the County Council will receive the first quarter 2021 budget presentation. It looks like the amount of local sales tax rose a bit for first quarter 2020 and again for 2021, but the tax revenues have dipped for the transient room tax, the restaurant tax, and the wrap tax. Can you tell us by how much?
Well, I mean, it depends on the specific tax itself. We've seen some that are down year over year 20 to 30%, mainly around lodging and restaurant. And then, you know, the other part is that we've seen, you know, we're seeing weakness in some of those taxes, some of those other sales taxes around transportation and then general sales tax. Although the quarter so far is fairly good, we're just seeing the January numbers a little bit into February, we got to wait another month or so to see the real picture of how the end of January, beginning of February, into March are really going to treat us.
All right. So at this point, is it dire?
It's not dire. I think countywide, we're seeing somewhat lower than last year, but I mean, we remember that the first quarter of 2020 was very good, so we just need to take that into account. We've certainly adjusted to that as we budgeted for 2021. According to how we're running with most of our general and transportation sales taxes through 2021, we're still doing very well according to the way we budgeted. But I think we're going to see weakness with TRT, restaurant tax, and wrap tax, but we also accounted for that within our budget as well.
All right. So since we're not seeing the sales taxes we may have wanted to see, does that mean that we need to increase property taxes?
No, I don't believe that's the case. Property taxes have their own adjustment mechanisms within them in order that the local governments receive the same level of collections as from the year previous, and that's automatically adjusted. We haven't also seen dips in property values yet. We expect to see some weakness in commercial property values, but so far the evidence, I mean, that's kind of seems intuitive based on what's been experienced, but so far the comparable sales are not bearing that out.
All right. There will also be a review of the county's vaccination expense expectations, just over $2 million. So this is paying for what? Just the the vaccine and the hypodermics, or what else does it pay for?
Oh, no, no, it's not paying for that kind of stuff at all. That stuff is being provided through the system that's distributing the vaccine to the states. This is really paying for the whole operation of providing vaccines. I mean, we have several staff dedicated to this effort. We've rented equipment in order to roll this out. We're certainly engaged with the film studio and helping to pay for different things. I mean, for instance, you know, they're allowing us to use the facility, but we're going to pay utilities for the portion that we're using, and other things like that. So it's a rather large operation, you know, the great thing is that that's not being borne by the taxpayers of Summit County. We've got several, as you read the staff report, there's been several different grant sources that have been provided down to local governments and health districts in order to help distribute the vaccine.
All right, so will this be covered by the funding that you've already received, or are we looking to the new American Rescue Plan for that?
So far, it's been covered by the money we've received. This operation is going to last a few more months, so there will be more expenses. But we also know that the American Rescue Act is coming forward. And so we're going to be looking at other impacts of the pandemic, because that's what it's all driven by. The expenditures that you're allowed to make, I mean, at least the guidance we've received so far is that if you can document impacts to your community around different things, that's what you can expend some of these funds on. So we're beginning that process.
All right. Summit County's mask mandate. The state is due to lift its mask mandate Saturday, April 10th. However, the county could keep a mask mandate, but three metrics have to be met. The 14-day case rate lowers to under 191 per 100,000 people. The 7-day average ICU utilization is under 15%, and more than 1.6 million prime doses delivered. So the state's estimating that these metrics will be met by mid-May. Will the county staff recommend keeping the mask mandate?
Well, I think, you know, it's a mixed bag. We've been having a lot of internal debates about this because, you know, our local statistics around vaccination uptake, around case spread, all of those things, you know, hospital capacity, those things that we look at. Summit County is doing extremely well. But, you know, we also know that we have a visitor-based tourism economy, plus a workforce that travels in and out every day. So we're concerned about that, as well as the different variants that are starting to see some traction within the United States. So, you know, we're concerned about all of those things together. And as well, the chamber has been helpful in helping to do some survey work of their membership to understand what the business community is desiring out of further masking and controls. You know, we have a wonderful uptake, an exciting uptake of the vaccine in Summit County. So all of these things are going to be weighed, plus the council members are going to be probably talking to their constituencies and doing some of their own data gathering to make some decisions. But we'll talk about it over the next 2 weeks and get some direction from the council this week to see what might need to happen. So far, our businesses largely are saying that they will continue mask mandates within their businesses, even if the local government or the state lift theirs. So I think there's a lot of desire to keep on some level of controls that we're used to and that we can keep in place as long as we possibly can.
Well, I guess if the three benchmarks are met, does the county have to drop the mask mandate?
We don't have to drop the mask mandate. It just becomes more of a, for lack of a better word, bureaucratic process to keep them in place, where we have to work with the governor's office and the legislature to make sure that they're okay if we do that. And of course, we would have to agree to put those in place locally. So it just becomes more cumbersome. And perhaps it also just becomes unusual based on what other counties might be doing. And, you know, we're going to look at what the counties are doing around us, too, because they have a big effect on us also.
So any plans to take public comment on this?
Well, I mean, it is noticed that the council can take public input. We did that on purpose so that the council has that flexibility. So anybody that does want to express an opinion to the council, I believe they'll have that opportunity.
All right. Council also going to talk about traffic calming on Bear Hollow Drive. Apparently, the neighborhood HOA has strongly voted in favor of installing, what, 3 center islands. Does the council have to make a decision about this?
Well, it's not necessarily a decision item, because the we have budgeted money in order to do the neighborhood group voted on and approved. So we're planning on moving forward with it, unless there's a fatal flaw that the council sees in that. We just wanted to make sure that both the public and the council saw the results of this latest effort. These same or similar types of treatments to the roadway were not successfully voted on or positively voted on in the last time this was done, a couple of years ago. Conditions have changed. The neighborhood is organized a little bit differently, and we're ready to fulfill their desire to get some speed controls on Bear Hollow Drive.
All right. The council will hear the appeal of the Wylerway Ranch, an appeal record of some 850 pages. Originally, the Snyderville Planning Commission sent council a negative recommendation. The council remanded it back to the Planning Commission. The Planning Commission then sent a negative recommendation for a second time. Are we making any headway here?
Well, I think we're making headway. I mean, the two questions that the council asked as they sent this back to the Planning Commission was, you know, first, does it meet the architectural standards for this type of structure? And then does it meet the scale standard? The Planning Commission agreed that it does meet the architectural standard, but was not comfortable with the size of the building on the size of lot that it was in. It's for this subdivision or plat. Within Silver Creek, it's a little over 2 acres, and the Planning Commission didn't agree that a large accessory building at about 15,000 square feet meets that scale standard. So that's what's being appealed. So now it's back in front of the council.
All right. Let's see, a public hearing on the code amendments for the accessory buildings. We had heard from Planning Commissioner Thomas Cook about the Snyderville Basin planning recommendation, but he said that they sent on an 80-20 decision. That is, with a few issues left for council to decide. For instance, does the council want to completely ban steel shipping containers? Any idea where the council's
going? Well, I don't have any idea. I mean, in reading through the staff report, it also kind of surprised me that one was in there. I hadn't been following the issue of the steel shipping containers. I know that it is an issue out in our community. So I'm glad that the Planning Commission was weighing in on that. But that, I'm sure, will be a discussion item for the council. And of course, it's a public hearing item also, so there's an opportunity for the public to express what they feel about accessory buildings to the council today.
All right. And then Monday's meeting at the Richens Building to meet with Congressman Blake Moore was the first in-person meeting we've had, you've had in what, a year?
Easily. I mean, we were all very just it was surprising, I guess, or unusual for us to see each other in person. I don't believe I've seen Melina Stevens since December in person, and most of the council members very sporadically over the last year, depending on what's going on. And so, but you know, with when the
Representative Moore wants to come and see us. We were able to accommodate that in a socially distanced manner in one of our buildings and spend a good hour and a half with the congressman talking about some of the highest priority issues within Summit County.
So was there anything that you would like to get help from Representative Moore and the federal government for?
Well, I don't think it's unusual. I mean, first of all, we're certainly appreciative of some of the work that's been done in the recent past on the pandemic relief and the pandemic response. So we express that. But our highest priorities kind of go around transportation, traffic congestion, transit, as well as environmental sustainability and some of our watershed and wildfire management. I think our biggest asks as he moves forward in his first term is kind of matching what's coming out of the Congress right now in some infrastructure legislation. So, you know, we're, as everybody knows, the High Valley Transit District is standing up and getting active. We continue to apply for large federal grants around our bus rapid transit system on 224. We are going to be purchasing buses in the future and have some requests in for federal funds on that. And then, you know, the project for improving the Kimball Junction interchange and the roadways, and especially the state highway through that area, are projects that are moving forward very quickly. And so if we can get some federal help with that, that would be wonderful as well.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
I just wanted to mention that the Timberline Special Service District has some openings. This is one that's sometimes a little difficult to recruit to, but if you're a resident of Timberline and you desire to serve, please let us know. We'll keep this open until it's filled.
Okay. Tom Fisher, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
And Summit County Manager, again, Tom Fisher. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. News time now, 8:42. Well, as we just noted, the Summit County Council and several other county officials convened yesterday morning in person with the new 1st Congressional District Representative, Blake David Moore. KPCW's Rick Bruff has details.
Moore, a Republican, has been in Congress nearly 3 months after he was elected last fall to succeed longtime 1st District Representative Rob Bishop. Meeting with county officials at the Rich and Services Building, he said that the GOP in Washington want to be, as he put it, aspirational, pro-growth, and inclusive. He said his objective is not to be partisan, but to do whatever he can to be productive. Moore said his constituents won't see a lot of rhetoric from him. The congressman was briefed on some of the major items occupying the county. Foremost among those are transportation items like a major improvement to Kimball Junction and bus rapid transit on 224. With the Wasatch Cache National Forest in their backyard, county officials also said they're concerned about watershed protection and wildlife mitigation and hope to invite the congressman back for an extended tour. They also reviewed the county's COVID vaccination efforts. After the meeting, we asked Congressman Moore what he sees as the most divisive issue right now in the Congress.
Immigration is becoming a really hot topic right now. I think people are willing to find a solution, but there's a lot of blaming going on. And I don't know if that was expected to be the case, but immigration has been really a hotbed of discussion lately.
We also asked, where is there a chance for bipartisan cooperation? He said that's a more difficult question to answer.
Even though there's very narrow margins, 50-50 Senate, very narrow margin in the House, but because of the Senate switching to Democrat control, even though it's a 50-50 split, there's a very opportunistic push right now among Democrat leadership to just get a lot of the legislation through. Whether or not it goes through the Senate or not isn't wrong. So there hasn't been a bunch of committee work. The first quarter, there was a rule placed that allowed for previous legislation to get put through without going through any committee or markup, and that ends on April 1st.
Moore said he did see some reason for optimism.
So besides just one particular topic, I'm hopeful that as we get back working in committee, and hopefully there'll be opportunities with the infrastructure package that's coming for there to be more bipartisanship. I still think it's going to be a very Democrat-controlled process, but hopefully with the new process in place, with the expiring of the rule that was put in after April 1st, there'll at least be more discussion going on. So hopefully that helps, you know, creates a little bit more bipartisanship.
Utah 1st District Congressman Blake David Moore. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
As we've reported, a new petition on change.org is asking people to sign if they want to reinstate the access to Forest Service lands from the top of the 9990 chairlift at Park City Mountain Resort. One of those leading up the petition is Megan McKenna. Good morning to you, Megan.
Good morning, Leslie.
So there were, of course, the two deaths due to avalanches this winter, and while the conditions have certainly mellowed since midwinter, the resort is saying that it will keep the gates closed for the rest of the season, and it's certainly, I guess, their prerogative. So why should they reopen?
That's a really good question, and I think they should reopen the access because I think the public should always have access to their public lands. I think, as I mentioned in the petition, we understood the immediate closure of it, although it's unprecedented. It hasn't happened in the past. I think given the extreme conditions with the black rose that we saw, the danger rose on the avalanche forecast, I think many of us, and being so shooken by the loss of especially a local backcountry skier loved and known by many of us in the community. And I think the ongoing closure is where we have a concern.
So do you think the petition will do any good?
I think so. And I think that was the intention to put it out there is I think there is a lot of support to keep access to our public lands. And so I wanted the resorts and I wanted the community to see that. And I think it's showing that now.
Certainly, the 9990 chairlift wasn't always there. Back in the day, people had to earn their turns, people who had the equipment, the know-how. They knew how to gauge avalanche conditions. The gate has made it too easy and too tempting for many who don't know what they're doing. And despite the signs telling people that they can die crossing into the backcountry, I mean, people who have no business being there just walk through knowing this. And I think that the resort, it sounds like the resort just is like, we don't want to see anybody else die. So this is the easy solution.
I think you're right. I think it is an easy solution, but I think it doesn't solve the problem. And so I think that's why we'd like to have an ongoing discussion with all the stakeholders, all the people that are involved in it. I think the lift, the location of the lift is problematic, like you said, for all of those reasons, but it's there. And so I think the proper solution moving forward is to find the safest access with that lift there. And I think just closing the access may create other problems and that involve safety as well. So I think moving forward, I think involving other stakeholders and the people that have to enforce that rope line and the people that use it safely, I think should have a voice in that decision.
So those other problems you're referring to, just people going somewhere else that maybe they shouldn't be?
Yeah, and I think that's been shown when you close access, people access it illegally and in less safe ways. And right now, the hike on 9990 is the safest access to the ridge. Like I said, it is problematic, and so I think many of us have been open to ideas and focused on finding other solutions, and that's what we would like to discuss.
Well, and that seems to be part of the frustration here, that it just you're getting the silent treatment. You say you've made phone calls, you've sent emails, and nothing. No response like, thank you for the phone call, thank you for the email. And it's just telling you that we're not opening, but I guess if you did get the chance to meet, what do you think you could say that would change their minds?
I think we could provide a local voice from people that actually use it and could show that many of us work really hard to improve the safety of that. For 5 years now, I've been facilitating an avalanche class through Park City High School through a grant through the Ed Foundation, trying to educate future backcountry users, future stewards of our public lands. And I think that's really important. I think the education approach long-term will benefit our community more than a more punitive approach to it.
Yeah, and apparently there is an agreement that was signed back in 1998 by ASC, American Skiing Company, the former owners there of the canyon. And that was when they were moving forward with their ski development plans, and they wanted buy-in from Save Our Canyons, from CARG, and the Wasatch Mountain Club, some of the critics of the development. Among other things, the agreement required the resort to keep its lift terminals at least 300 feet below the ridgeline, and the idea was to keep skiers out of the restricted areas defined by Save Our Canyons as Big Cottonwood Canyon, Upper Mill Creek, and U.S. Forest Service land, as well as no summer access there from 9990. The agreement, however, did allow for a backcountry access corridor. So in return, Save Our Canyons agreed to refrain from taking an adverse position and opposing the proposed ski development. The development, though, as we know, has been approved. It's halfway built. So we've really lost our leverage here then, no?
Yes, I think so. And that was always my impression of the agreement when I worked at the canyons. I, as a ski patroller and had to enforce that rope line, that was part of my job. I was under the impression that we had to keep access to the public land. And I'm not aware of any changes in that agreement.
Yeah. It also states like the agreement is binding on future owners. So it sounds like that Vail Resorts can't shut the gate. I mean, rather than doing the petition route, why not just hire an attorney to enforce the agreement?
Well, I think as a teacher and a backcountry skier, hiring a lawyer and going against a large corporation doesn't seem like seems more challenging than I think the petition I thought would be effective, because I know there's a lot of community support and I felt like our voices just weren't being heard, and so it seemed like a reasonable route to share our voices with the with Vail Resorts.
Yeah. So have you approached Save Our Canyons at all to see if they're willing to help enforce it?
I haven't personally, but I know that some people in the community have. I think many of us have been working on our own to try to reach out to anyone that we know that can help. And so this was a way that I thought we could bring the community together and bring our voices together to try to make a better informed decision for all involved.
Yeah. And as we know, next year's season passes are on sale. And I guess you're just trying to figure out whether or not you buy one or not. 20% off.
Yeah, I haven't made that decision yet. And for me, it really does hinge on this access and not just the ability to ski the backcountry, but to support a company that supports the public access to our public lands.
Yeah, so do you think you'll get some kind of answer? Or I'm not just you and the rest of the backcountry, people who do buy passes really to get that access?
I think so. We've already seen in just the 24 hours that the petition's been up quite a bit of response. And so I do expect to hear from Vail. I think they've already put out a statement. And so I think that's a start that they are communicating that they have decided to keep it closed for the season. And so I think we'll hear more. And I do look forward to other leaders in the community, whether it's our nonprofits, our elected officials and representatives, business owners that also feel empowered now to speak up for access to our public lands.
Yeah. And I see the argument people are making. You know, this is not a nanny state. People can look out for themselves. At the same time, when you have people dying at your doorstep, it's the resort kind of getting the bad rap for it. I mean, so it's, I guess, bottom line, you're asking Vail just to, you know, to turn their head and not watch this, or?
No, I don't think we're asking them to turn their head. I think that's a really important point. And I think the victims' family members are a stakeholder too. And I think their voices should be heard and should be an important part of this discussion moving forward.
So if people are interested in joining you, I think you were looking for 1,000. You're probably above that well by now. What do people need to do?
You can go to change.org/national-forward-access-petition. From there, you can sign the petition. You can comment. You can voice your concern. And you can help advocate for access to our public lands.
Okay. Anything else you want to add?
Well, I just want to say thanks, Leslie, for having me here. And I think this petition came about, I was reminded of one of my favorite quotes from Edward Abbey. He says, sentiment without action is the ruin of the soul. And I think we've all experienced the loss and the tragedy that this last year has brought. And I think all of us could use some food for our soul. And I think this is an excellent way to advocate for something in our community that's so important to our soul. Our open lands and open space that we share are part of what we value in this community. And so I just urge everyone that has a voice, and everyone does have a voice in this community, to speak up for what we value here and for the future generations of not just backcountry skiers, but stewards of our public lands.
All right. Megan McKenna, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you very much, Leslie.
Well, as Summit County weathered the past pandemic year, it resorted to a number of programs to help businesses slammed by COVID. One of those efforts was the Economic Development Advisory Board. Summit County Economic Development Director Jeff Jones says that the board was formed last summer. It was enabled by the recently passed Senate Bill 95 that created a rural county grant program to help business. A 9-member board was formed, including Francis Mayor Brian Ames and Camas Mayor Matt McCormick. They have met almost monthly to disperse the grant money. Jones said that the planned grant amount was originally $200,000, but it was cut back to $95,000 due to COVID. From there, about $47,000 was allocated to each side of the county. He said that the funding on the west side was aimed largely at the foods sector during the colder months.
We called that grant the Outdoor Hospitality Grant, and the purpose of that grant program was to assist businesses that, say, were expanding infrastructure like outside of the footprint, like for tents and things, in order to increase the amount of spacing or to accommodate, say, the accommodation and food service sector, or to assist the arts, entertainment, recreation sector.
The grants for the east side were a bit different.
As we move into winter, they slow down. Their big time is during the summer. We're a little more flexible with a small business grant on the east side. It was targeted to companies that were adding new employees, that were either in full-time, part-time, contract labor, but also for business retention as well.
For the coming year, Jones says that they're going to update their economic development strategy. They'll be sending out surveys to residents and businesses asking about the county's strengths, weaknesses, and possible next moves. Some residents may say that Summit County doesn't need further development given the numbers attracted here during the pandemic. However, Jones says that there have been some troubling numbers.
You know, coming through the pandemic, we're down about 4,000 jobs from our 2019 level. We lost, coming through the pandemic, 3.1% of the county's gross regional product. And so there may be some ways in which we can grow not just for the more, but that we can grow also for the better.
And affordable housing, he says, is still an issue.
Those that were in the lower wage earners suffered a lot more job losses than those that were high wage earners or middle income earners. And so the need for affordable housing is probably still there. We also have a significant share of existing residents that are still paying more than the targeted 30% of their gross income for housing. Yeah. And so the burden of housing is still present.
That's Jeff Jones.